great advice, guests, and the information you need to take your marriage, family, and personal life to the next level.
Weekdays at noon on Ave Maria Radio.
Catholic Radio in Metro Detroit. This is 990 WDEO, Ypsilanti Detroit, or on the internet at WDEO.net.
My guest this hour has been on Church and Culture before several times. Robert Riley is the director of the Westminster Institute here in Washington, D.C. He was the director of Voice of America. He has been senior advisor for information strategy for the U.S. Secretary of Defense. He's written a number of important books that are particularly relevant. The one that is most relevant for this particular conversation is The Closing of the Muslim Mind, How Intellectual Suicide Created the Modern Islamist Crisis. Bob Riley, welcome to Church and Culture again.
Thank you, Dale.
Bob, we're seeing in Europe an incredible crisis of immigration, of refugees, and initially countries like Germany tried to be open to receiving them. The Holy Father, Pope Francis, has encouraged all people of goodwill, especially Catholics, to take part in this welcoming of the refugees. What, however, is the danger that this influx can contain some serious terrorist elements?
Well, I think that's just one element of the problem, and I think we can rest assured since, according to one report, 74% of these migrants are male, that some of them indeed are plants from ISIS and Al-Qaeda and other groups. You can't have massive flows of people of the dimensions which we're speaking and keep control of it. Just to give you a little example, Deal, in 2014, Germany took about a third of the asylum applicants to the European Union, and that was almost 203,000. This year, Germany alone, 800,000, so close to a fourfold increase. Just in the past week on Sunday and Monday, 22,000 migrants crossed from Hungary into Austria in 2 days.
Wow.
So Europe is in danger of being swamped. Just as a little example, the Holy Father said the Vatican would take one family. How many families from this influx could the Vatican take and still remain the Vatican and not become something else because of the character of the population that it is receiving? It certainly would no longer be Catholic or even Christian. And this is what alarms the Prime Minister of Hungary, Mr. Orban, who gave a speech and simply said, we Hungarians don't want global mass migration to change our country. He said we have to defend Hungary and Europe, the borders of the country, our way of life, our culture, and sovereignty. And I think that's a little reminder that we shouldn't confuse compassion with charity. One's heart, of course, naturally opens when you see these images of these people, not all of whom are poor, by the way, and face down on a Turkish beach, this young little boy, this Kurdish boy. And, of course, one wants to help. And there are ways of helping, short of mass migration to Europe, which can become so serious that it changes the character of Europe. If Europe, you know, first of all, a country has an obligation not to every poor person in the world, but to its citizens. And whereas we all have individual obligations to charity, a country doesn't necessarily. Its obligations are to its citizens and certainly to its less fortunate citizens. It doesn't have an obligation to open its borders to unrestricted immigration from populations of another culture and another faith. And I think one reason Europe doesn't seem to understand what it's doing to itself is its own loss of faith.
Well, it looks as if Hungary is going to go ahead and continue building some sort of barrier to these immigrants. Is that, I mean, from a point of view of Catholic social teaching, is there a problem there?
I don't think so. I don't think there's anything wrong with what Prime Minister Orbán of Hungary said. It's a sovereign country whose responsibilities are primarily to its citizens, not to massive flows of migrants from other countries and other cultures, most of whom are simply seeking a better way of life. I mean, the core of the problem here is the dysfunctional nature of the Middle East. I mean, there were always immigrant flows from the Middle East because it's dysfunctional. But now, of course, because of the outbreak of violence, the civil war, the multifaceted civil war, we're having these problems. And lost within these larger questions is what is happening to the Christians. They're the minority that is being wiped out. As a Iraqi sister, Diana Momaka, testified to the House Foreign Affairs Committee late last spring, and I'm quoting from her, ISIS's plan is to evacuate the land of Christians and wipe the earth clean of any evidence that we ever existed, unquote. And that's why Pope Francis made the statement when he was on his trip to Latin America, referring to the Middle East, that this is genocide. So what we're trying to do, not just at the Westminster Institute, but at Barnabas Aid, which is an allied organization, both of which are led by Dr. Patrick Soukdeo, is to help the Christians, both by providing some tent housing and aid in northern Iraq, and also by trying to extricate the Christians who really cannot go home, and they don't have any home to return to. So in a program called Operation Safe Havens, Barnabas Aid, on a very modest scale, is extricating families through Beirut to countries which will provide them with visas. And this turns out, first of all, to be Poland. Poland, by the way, won't have anything to do with this mass immigration, this close to unrestricted mass immigration, but it has a lot. It's a first step. It's allowing 200 Christian families into Poland by this Barnabas Aid project, tied in with a local NGO in Poland that then works with local parishes to place these families. So these are Christian Catholics from Syria and Iraq who are finding new homes, new parishes, and a way to integrate into these societies at no cost to the Polish government.
Is this a program that may likely expand to other European countries or even to the United States?
Yes, as soon as the visas are available. I had a piece in the Wall Street Journal in late August on the op-ed page on what called Exterminating Christians in the Middle East, in which I mentioned this Safe Havens project from Barnabas Aid, and I got some generous responses from Americans saying, my wife and I will host a Christian family for a year.
Really?
Yeah, and I have to tell them thank you for your generosity, but we can't get them visas to come to the United States.
I understand there's something like 250,000 visas given to Muslim families in the United States every year under the Obama administration.
I would be, well, maybe that includes South Asia, Africa, and the Middle East. Those certainly aren't the numbers for Syria or Iraq. It's much smaller, though. President Obama just made an announcement that there will be an increase for Syria. But within those numbers so far, the proportion of Christians who are allowed into the United States from Syria is less than the percentile they represent in the Syrian population.
And they're already a very small percentage in the Syrian population.
Well, no, they were 10%.
Well, relatively, I mean,
they're
so.
they're much less now, and well, compared to, you know, say 1% of the Iraqi population, which has been purged over the past decade. But so this hemorrhage of Christians, there is the Barnabas Aid Program will expand according to the number of visas that can be provided for these persecuted Christians. That's the problem. The problem is not so much the resources as it is the visas. I mean, it costs $3,000 per person in terms of airfare and 1 year's basic support to relocate these people into a country like Poland.
And how many of you are you planning on relocating at this point?
Well, in Poland, 200 families to start with, and modest numbers in a couple of other countries. And part of the effort is to lobby these countries to please allow in more. In our visa application process, you know, in the United States, there's no special category for persecuted Christians, which leaves us in a position, as I tried to point out in the Wall Street Journal, we kept the Jews out in the early 1940s, and we know what happened to them. And we are doing the same thing to these persecuted Christians.
Yeah, I remember that famous ship full of Jews that
that's right.
were not allowed to come into any United States port.
The Jews were abandoned, and we are abandoning these Christians. Last weekend, I had the privilege of hearing the Patriarch of Antioch for the Syriac Catholic Church, Ignatius Youssef Younan, who gave a very frank talk, and he said, we have been abandoned. We have been betrayed. And he also made quite clear what the origin of the threat to the Christian community is. And it's not just ISIS or Al-Qaeda. He made it very clear that there's really no difference between the ideology of those organizations and the ideology of the Muslim Brotherhood and Hassan al-Banna, who founded them back in 1928. And that all of these groups, of course, are offshoots of the mothership, which is the Muslim Brotherhood. And ironically, the United States was not supporting, in fact, was objecting when President al-Sisi in Egypt, then General al-Sisi, threw Morsi over, Morsi being the Muslim Brotherhood dictator of Egypt at the time. So we don't have our heads screwed on right about what represents the danger in the Middle East and why it is leading to the genocide of Christians there. And the least we can do is help these people. And the Barnabas Aid and Patrick Sukdeo make very clear that just because we can't save everyone doesn't mean we shouldn't save someone.
Of course.
So, 200 families, that doesn't sound like much, but it's a hell of a lot better than not saving those 200 families and the others and providing very effective aid in country to displaced Christians, of which there are probably about a million.
Bob, let me ask you this question that I'm sure is on the minds of some of our listeners is, what is behind the influx of the last few months into Europe? Why did this this river of people suddenly start surging into Eastern and Central Europe?
Well, I think there are two reasons. One, it's a manifestation of the level of violence in the Middle East, particularly in Syria and Iraq. Most of these people are coming from Syria. And the second is the traffickers and smugglers are succeeding. And Europe has created an incentive for these people to come.
What's the incentive?
And the incentive is, we welcome you and we'll support you. And so, they want to go to Germany because they know that's the place where they'll get the best deal. It's one of the few countries that has at least a very modest growth in its economy, and it has a very generous welfare system. So, so they're not idiots. They know where to go. They want to go to Sweden. They want to go to Germany. You know, the problem is that the percentage of foreign citizens in these places is spiking in a very short period of time. In less than 10 years in Sweden, it's gone from 12% of the population to 16.5%. In Italy, it's doubled from 4% to 8%. You know, how long can you sustain changes in the nature of your population, particularly when those changes involve people of another culture that do not accept the fundamental basics of democratic constitutional order?
Well, there are also families who have more children and who haven't, you know, adopted contraception as abortion, a way of limiting the size of their families.
Well, you see, you've touched on another nerve there, and that is the demographic decline of Europe, which is particularly severe in Germany, and it's why Germany presently has such a huge Turkish population, because for many years they allowed Turks in because they needed workers. So there's a kind of rationale from that angle, and it's been reported in Germany that attendance at mosques has doubled just this summer. And you have to look around Europe and see whether these new populations are going to assimilate. And the evidence from places certainly like Great Britain,
and France, right?
Well, and France and other countries is that they don't. And, of course, notoriously bringing Paris out of the banlieues, which are inhabited by Muslims, which is sort of a country inside a country in France. And so this is very dangerous. This is very risky. And the Hungarian prime minister is one of the few ones frank enough to talk about this danger. I think it exhibits two things: Europe's loss of faith and its demographic decline. Its loss of a sense of itself to the extent that it doesn't recognize the dangers of what it's doing. And of course, Europe failed to do anything in the Middle East that might have prevented this mass migration.
Now, we've seen the spectacle of the Prime Minister of Germany, Merkel, initially kind of lecturing those in her country who were opposed to accepting all these refugees with open arms, and she, at least for a while, tried to claim the moral high ground, but now she seems to be backing away from that. Is that correct?
Well, I think she recognizes that she's got to reassert some kind of element of control here, and that she may be responding to some people's survival instinct.
Well, they're receiving around 10,000 a day.
Well, it's, you know, she said they'll take 800,000. So I doubt if they'll be able to limit it to those numbers, because it's the flow has gotten out of control. The incentives are there for it to continue. There are 2 million refugees in Turkish camps. There are another 2 million refugees in Lebanese camps.
These are refugees, some of them going back as far as 40 years or 50 years, correct?
No.
I mean, the ones in Lebanon go back to the Arab-Israeli wars.
Well, I don't think you could say that a majority are a product of that.
I didn't say majority, but I'm saying these camps in Lebanon, for example,
well,
go back
Jordan
far
Lebanon,
as that.
There are, you know, in Jordan and Lebanon, of course, there have been refugee camps, you were correct, for many, many years, but you know, not on the scale of the problem that they're dealing with now. And there are 6 million displaced people inside Syria. So you can see the potential there, but of course, they're coming from Eritrea. They're coming from not just Arab African countries, but Sudan. They're coming from a number of countries, Niger, because it's far more attractive than what they face in their home countries. And as long as Europe provides the incentive for them to do it, and the traffickers and smugglers are semi-successful in getting them there.
Let me stop you there. You talk about the traffickers and smugglers. It's not immediately apparent to me, maybe perhaps our listeners, what you mean. Are you talking about, are they kind of recruiters, as it were?
They run a terrible business, and they make a lot of money smuggling people, and people pay a lot of money because they want to get out.
But it looks like to me like these people arriving on trains coming through Hungary aren't being smuggled.
No, that's because they've already gotten there, and the way they get there is to cross over from Bodrum and other Turkish ports in these rickety boats to the nearby Greek island of Kos or Lesbos. And once they're in, they're kind of home free.
This is why the former sort of paradisical islands in the Aegean have become so chaotic.
Right.
So this is, in other words, they're smuggled out of Turkey. And once they're out, then they make their way to Hungary or Germany, wherever they're going.
That's exactly right.
Now, is Greece taking any of the refugees?
I can't speak to that. I don't know the numbers in Greece. But, of course, Greece is in a catastrophic economic situation and doesn't have the capacity economically to absorb these people. But it's you have to applaud, as your heart goes out, the Greek Navy, they've been saving people in these rickety boats. And as callous as this may sound, so long as they save them, they'll send more rickety boats with people for them to save.
It sounds a lot like the situation with Mexican immigrants who are paying their way to get smuggled across our borders.
Well, of course it is, many of these migrants pay a lot of money, and they come with enough money to stay in hotels in Greece until they can make it further north. The terrible situation of this Kurdish family that was lost at sea, except for the husband. They weren't poor. He had some money. They had an apartment in Turkey. He was Kurdish from the town of Kobani. Of course, Kobani was largely wiped out in the fight between ISIS and the Kurds. So he didn't want to stay, and he was in Turkey, and he takes this great risk to cross the sea in a rickety boat without any life jackets. And so you have these losses. And the problem is they're incentivizing this risk. At a certain point, it's not a favor to these people to do this. And the care should be given to them where they are, unless Europe wants to see itself transformed into something other than what it is and what it has been.
If you were advising Chancellor Angela Merkel of Germany, would you just have them just start denying benefits to anyone else who tries to come across the border?
I think that Germany has created a situation that is untenable.
So there has to be a change of policy at some point.
I think there has to be a change in policy. I would encourage the generosity and visas for the population that is most at risk of being eliminated in a genocide, and those are the Christians. First of all, help those, and they come from a faith that's compatible, at least with the founding faith of Germany. I know that in Austria, some refugee Catholic families are being given parishes that would otherwise be closed or abandoned. So through the generosity of the Catholic Church in Austria, they are trying to help with that kind of thing. There should be more of that. Save the people who are going to be killed and
beheaded.
Have a home to which to return.
I'm talking with Bob Riley, who is the director of the Westminster Institute, who, as he described earlier, is trying to do something about rescuing these Christian families, at least at the beginning, finding them homes in Poland. And we'll be talking more with Bob Riley about this crisis in Europe and other matters pertaining to Muslim terrorism just after this message.
Light of the East, weekends on Ave Maria Radio.
I'm Father Thomas Loya. This week on Ave Maria, it is not Go West, Young Man, but Turn East, Young Man, as one fine group of young men are doing, and we will see how this can make a difference in the church and for society.
Saturday evenings at 8:30 and Sunday mornings at 9 on 990 WDEO, Ave Maria Radio.
Hi, this is Father John Ricardo, inviting you to join me as we explore some of the deepest questions that arise in our hearts, questions that shape the way we think, the way we speak, and the way we live. For all of these questions, Christ is the answer.
On our next Christ is the Answer program, Father John Ricardo wrestles with the question, can we trust the biblical vision of marriage? He looks at marriage, personal relationships, love, prayer, scripture, our personal wills, and what our Lord wants for us and our families. Listen to Christ is the Answer, Wednesday evenings at 8, Saturday afternoons at 5, and Sunday mornings at 11 on Ave Maria Radio and AveMariaRadio.net on the Internet.
Christ is the way, the truth, and the life. He is the image of the invisible God. He points us to our destiny. He reveals the dignity of the human person. He is the one who makes known the Father. Christ is the Answer.
Christ is the Answer is brought to you by the Ave Maria Communications Guild.
If you want to use your gifts and talent to support women and the unborn, contact the Arbor Women Pregnancy Center to volunteer. Arbor Women needs pro-life people to support, nurture, and empower women facing unexpected pregnancies. Arbor Women are in need of nurses and sonographers with a current Michigan license, as well as pregnancy and post-abortion counselors. Call the volunteer coordinator at 734-994-8863. That's 734-994-8863 to learn how you can help.
Back with Bob Riley, director of the Westminster Institute. We're talking about the refugee crisis in Eastern and Central Europe. Bob, we talked a little bit earlier about the way in which Pope Francis has been publicly urging people of goodwill, Catholics in particular, to welcome the refugees and to take them on, say, parish by parish. I noticed in an interview with a Portuguese newspaper a few days ago that he did address the question I asked you initially in this program, and that is, you know, what is the terror threat of these thousands of people coming into Europe over the last month or so? And he said it was significant. It was certainly there, and he thought of Italy as being perhaps the most vulnerable because it was the closest to the heartland of Islamic terrorism.
Well, you know, Deal, that raises the question. By the way, I should mention something else about the Holy Father and his trip to the United States. Congressman Fortenberry, who is the co-chair of the House Caucus on Middle Eastern Minorities, introduced a resolution in the House of Representatives to declare what is happening to Christians and other minorities, such as the Yazidis, genocide. To formally recognize it as genocide and to call upon all the legal and international authorities to act on the basis that it is genocide and to hold the people responsible for it in some legal manner. This is a wonderful step to draw attention to this issue, and a number of people in a bipartisan manner are co-sponsoring this genocide resolution. Congressman Fortenberry had the occasion in a private audience with Pope Francis to show him a draft of this genocide resolution. And the Holy Father thanked him for it and said, you know, thank you, I'm going to look at this and consider it. So the hope is that with the great opportunity that Pope Francis has in the United States, particularly in addressing Congress, that he can continue to highlight precisely the issue of Christian persecution and call upon the United States to respond generously, specifically to that, to these people who will not survive this genocide unless some rescue is made for them. So that's the first point. The second point is to consider how within Islam does one understand this enormous influx of Muslims into Europe. Formally speaking, and I mean by that within Sharia, Muslims are not supposed to live in non-Muslim countries. In fact, they're told to leave, to live in a Muslim country. Now, the exceptions for this would be dawah, which is proselytization, the spread of Islam. You go somewhere to spread Islam. You can do it through dawah, which is a peaceful evangelization, or you can do it through jihad, which, of course, is war and conquest. Some people are calling this influx a dawah hijra. Hijra is a reference to Muhammad's flight to Mecca, and they're comparing this to that and calling it a hijra, which legitimizes it within Muslim legal thinking, insofar as these people are going there to proselytize. Now, a group like ISIS doesn't agree with that and tells them, don't go live in the land of the kufr, you should stay here, you know, in our new caliphate and live here. So that at least gives you a little perspective of how Muslims consider what they themselves are doing.
So that might in fact mean that there's may mitigate against the likelihood of ISIS being infiltrating these groups coming into Hungary and Germany.
Well, ISIS's concentration is first of all on establishing and consolidating the caliphate in the lands it controls in Syria and Iraq. That's its number one priority. Once it's solidified that, it will undertake the obligation of the caliphate, which is jihad. So that's its priority. But that doesn't mean groups like al-Nusra and al-Qaeda have changed their priorities, which was to hit the far abroad enemy before hitting the near enemy, being what they consider the apostate regimes in the Middle East, like Saudi Arabia and Jordan, and of course, Assad in Syria. But though the priorities may be different, the ultimate objective is not different, which is to subdue the infidel and the kufrs. So one would have to be very naive not to know that there will be infiltration and sleepers in these immigrant populations. And it's coming so fast that they have no way of controlling this. They have no way of finding out who is and who isn't. And particularly since you have such a huge number of males traveling alone as part of this mass migration.
By the way, does this mean that there are quite a few of these refugees leaving their families behind? Do we have any evidence of this?
I think this is happening so quickly, they don't know. But it's probable, and it's probable once they get established, that they'll then bring their families.
So it'll be very, very much the equivalent of what's happening here in the United States.
Well, it's an equivalent of what's happened in Great Britain and other places where, you know, they may have had more than one wife, and then eventually they'll bring all their wives and they'll live with all their wives, and in fact they'll receive welfare in order to do so. So it's you, you if You know, the great thing about the United States is we have assimilated people from any number of cultures. Of course, European cultures were where we were founded by Europeans. That wasn't too much of a problem. But Asians, South Americans, the Arabs in the United States are very successful. They are an upper middle class population. Of course, the majority of Arabs in the United States are Christian Arabs, not Muslim Arabs. But the Muslim Arabs in this country also do very well. And I've worked with Muslims for years, and the United States has this great ability to assimilate people so long as they recognize its fundamental principles.
By the way, since you published your book on closing the Muslim mind, and you've been quite visible as a commentator, what do you say to people who call you an Islamophobe?
Well, the closing of the Muslim mind is about to appear in Arabic, and it was translated into Arabic at the urging of Arab Muslim intellectual reformers who said, we need this book. Number two, we have at the Westminster Institute a new book called Reforming Islam. And this book has many Muslim Arab authors who directly address the origins of the dysfunctional state in their culture and what needs to be done. And most of them are unequivocal in saying we need to restore reason in Islam. Reason has been denigrated. We are, if I put this in Western terms, we are a sola scriptura culture that has abandoned reason, though we once had philosophy from the Greeks. We expelled it. If we're going to save our culture, we need to restore that the status of reason in it and the integrity of reason and reason's ability to come to know the truth. Now, anything I have ever been accused of saying as a symptom of Islamophobia, I can point to this book, Reforming Islam, and point to one of the chapters and say, well, that's what this Arab Muslim says. Is he an Islamophobe?
So this
Islamophobia thing is simply a technique to shut people up when they are diagnosing the heart of the problem in this dysfunctional culture. And what's happening in Islam is there is a civil war going on in Islam, and there are several civil wars going on within Islam. And why we shouldn't wish to see the side that is compatible with our own beliefs and interests win is beyond my reckoning. It's a minority view. It's a persecuted view. But it's the view we should support, and that's why the Westminster Institute and the Al-Musli, the Reformer Project out of England, work together to promote the thinking of the Muslim intellectual reformers as presented in this wonderful book, Reforming Islam, which will, by the way, be unveiled in London in its Arabic form, because that's the center of Arab media in London. So this can be disseminated within the Arab world. I think that the Islamophobia thing is just to shut people up.
How do you think that people who want to address this issue publicly, I mean, how can they speak about it without being accused of being hard-hearted, lacking compassion, ignoring the Holy Father, and so forth?
In terms of refugees?
Yes.
Well, I mean, you've just heard me say some rather harsh things, Deal, but what am I working with and promoting? Promoting Operation Safe Havens.
So in other words, an alternative.
Which is an alternative to help the most at-risk minority in the Middle East, the Christians, of every, and it's not sectarian. Certainly the ones being sent to Poland are Catholic, but any persecuted Christian of any Christian denomination. So, I mean, how heartless is this? Well, anyone who has $3,000 or, you know, can contribute at even a much smaller level can go to Barnabas Aid and help.
So, is that BarnabasAid1word.com?
You can just Google Barnabas Aid and it'll take you right to the website and to the Operation Safe Havens project where you can see what's being done. There's a camp in northern Iraq called Camp Saura, which Barnabas supports with the better tents and so forth than you'll find in a UN refugee camp, better provisions and care, again, for these persecuted Christians. So you can't save everyone. You can save someone. The people most at risk of being eliminated from the Middle East are the Christians. So there are ways to help them in place. They don't want to leave. This is their home. But some of them are in situ. There is no home to which to return. And they'll be killed if they don't leave. So those are the first people to help. The other people to help who are there, whom the Kurds are protecting, but whom need support to continue their temporary lives there. And so that's what something like Camp Saura, which it means hope in Arabic, tries to do.
If you were going to look 6 months ahead at this refugee crisis with the gradual closing of the border in Hungary, with the gradual change of attitude of Chancellor Merkel toward the refugees, that is throwing doubt on how long she'll continue to welcome these thousands into the Munich train station each week. How do you think it'll play out?
Of course, there will be accusations of heartlessness and heartbreaking scenes, but at a certain point, you have to remove the incentive for this flow. You have to stop subsidizing the flow. Otherwise, it will change the character of your own country and the problems that will arise in the future from an ever larger minority of Muslims is going to be great. It's going to be huge. So be generous in the sense of helping with the camps that exist in Turkey, in Lebanon, in Jordan. What are the very wealthy Arab countries doing? They're not letting these people in. The Muslim countries aren't letting these Muslim refugees in. What they are doing is providing billions of dollars to sustain them in these camps. And I think the focus of our charity should be there, not to move them all to Europe. But I'm going to give another dire assessment that this problem is going to get worse because there is no foreseeable solution to the chaos in the Middle East, which is the disintegration of the post-Ottoman artificial order that was imposed by mainly France and Great Britain after the collapse of the Ottoman Empire. That is disintegrating. And unfortunately, the only way that most of the Middle Easterners have to resolve their political and sectarian problems is through violence. Reason doesn't have a status there as an arbitrator in their disputes. Force does. And there is, with the exception of places like, say, Turkey and Persia, There is no natural political configuration that can fall in place now that the borders in the Middle East are collapsing. So the unfortunate prognostication is that for many years to come, these people are going to be fighting it out.
Which you said earlier, Bob, that there were 6 million displaced people inside of Syria. That's
right.
That's one third of the entire population. Syria has
it's
17.
Huge.
I mean, it's huge. So how did a third of the, and I know that perhaps our listeners are very familiar with what happened inside Syria, but remind us how a third of the Syrian population left their homes and began to live in the open and on the road and in camps.
I think it began with the Arab Spring and the at first peaceful uprising against Assad and the demand for a change. The brutal response of Assad's regime, the creation of some 1,200 opposition groups that began fighting Assad, then they became proxy groups for other countries that wished to determine the future of Syria by providing arms and equipment. The Gulf states, people in the Gulf states providing tremendous funding for the Sunnis, which includes the al-Nusra al-Qaeda offshoot, al-Qaeda itself, and then ISIS. Why are they providing them money? Because ISIS is fighting the Shia. And the Shia and the Iranians are supporting the Alawite Assad regime, because it's a kind of form of Shiism.
And that is that a lesser stringent form of Islam?
Well, the Alawites are a minority in Syria, and they've been ruling the country for half a century. And of course, it's been a very tough authoritarian regime. But the reason Christianity has been left alone is that minority regimes in Arab states only survive by making alliances with other minorities. This was true of Saddam in Iraq, because Iraq is a largely Shia country. So Saddam pretty much left the Christians alone in Iraq because he needed the support of other minority groups to sustain his rule. Now, this leaves the majorities in those countries with some grievances, and that's why the Shia behave in Iraq, now that they're controlling the country, in ways against the Sunni that have driven the Sunnis into the arms of ISIS.
And so they've been retaliating.
Because ISIS is the one group that's fighting the Shia.
Yeah.
And doing so effectively. And the same thing is happening in Syria, except, again, it's the Sunni majority of the country against the Alawite Shia minority, which is supported by Hezbollah in Lebanon, which is a proxy for Iran, and is being directly supported by Iran, and now by more actively by Russia, since it looks like the heartland, the Alawite heartland, is under threat from these Sunni revolutionary groups. So the most radical form of Islam seems to be the form that is most effective in fighting the Shia, and that's why other Sunnis are supporting them. And you'll find in polls the majority of people in Saudi Arabia support ISIS.
What is the significance of the Soviet presence, the building of an air force base in Syria?
Well, we'll call it the Russian presence rather than the Soviet, but it's protecting its own interests, its naval base in Syria, and it doesn't want the Assad regime, which, by the way, of course, was a Soviet proxy state under Assad's father, and the military in Syria was a Soviet supplied and trained military. And so this is a long relationship that goes back quite a ways. And they don't want to see Assad fail. And Russia also has a lot of worries about Sunni radical Islam in ISIS. And this is one of their means of trying to see that ISIS doesn't succeed.
But didn't the United States have a good relationship with Assad before this this Arab Spring?
No.
What was the relationship?
Of course, President Obama told him to leave office.
This was after the uprising, now.
Yes, it was after the uprising. But you have to recall that during the long period of the United States occupation of Iraq, that Assad's Syria was the principal avenue through which the Sunni jihadists reached into Iraq.
Ah.
So Syria was more than a major irritant in undermining the chance of any success of developing a sane constitutional regime in Iraq. So they were opponents, and I think the United States was extremely foolish in not preventing Assad's major interference in the internal affairs of Iraq. So the enmity there is longstanding and pretty much uninterrupted, with the exception of Assad's father when he participated in the liberation of Kuwait back in 91.
So the United States has seen Assad as a hostile, but has kept hands off in terms of trying to undermine him or to keep him from acting as a channel for either Sunni intervention or now Russian influence in the Middle East.
Well, you see what's happened. The Syria, you know, is the hand that fed the dog, and the dog is now biting the hand. Even though it was an Alawite regime, it encouraged the radical Sunni Islam by setting up these rat lines into Iraq and being an avenue for it. And now it's that very same radical Sunni Islamism that's turned on the Alawite Assad regime. So this is, you know, in terms of the United States, I'll just tell you, Syria loved playing the Kurdish card with Turkey. And this, I'm speaking now going back some years with Assad's father. So they would stir up trouble with the Kurds. They have themselves have a small Kurdish population in northern Syria. And so they would agitate the Kurds, creating problems for Turkey. So Turkey lined up a division on the Syrian border and called Assad, senior Assad, the father of the current Assad, and said, I forget whether there was a 48-hour time limit. They simply said, you are now no longer going to agitate the Kurds and provide any problem, or we're going to move in and eliminate the problem ourselves, perhaps including you. That was it. After that, Assad stopped, and there were no further problems for Turkey. The United States, when we were in Iraq, instead of ignoring this problem, should have done the same thing.
Should have called his bluff.
We should have delivered an ultimatum to Assad and told him this problem would stop or he would be eliminated. That's the, you know, force is the adjudicator in the Middle East. If you're not willing to use it, the other person will, even though they're weaker. And so we made a very big mistake in respect to that. And I believe if that had been done then, perhaps we wouldn't be facing the problems we are now. And the solution to it isn't moving the entire Middle East into Europe.
Bob, I've got to tell you our time is up. And you've been so informative to our listeners and to me, and I appreciate your being our guest again on Church and Culture. Look forward to having you back, and to all of you who are listening, please come back to Church and Culture at this time next week.
If you have any comments or questions about Church and Culture, you can contact Deal Hudson at dhudson@avemariaradio.net.
It's time for Family Man with Dr. Gregory Popchak.
People like to bash the faithful with statistics. For instance, you've probably heard that studies show that Christians divorce at the same rate as others. Or how about the report that claims that Christians are bad tippers? Well, according to the University of Connecticut sociologist Bradley Wright, statements like these simply don't apply to people who actually practice their faith. For instance, only 25% of weekly church-going Catholics are divorced compared to 50% of the general population. As for tipping, a Cornell University study found that church-going Christians tip an average of 17%. Obviously, Christians aren't perfect, but practicing our faith really does give us the grace we need to stand up against the pressures the world can apply. So the next time someone tries to bash your faith with research, take it with a grain of salt. I'm Dr. Greg Popchak, but you can call me Family Man.
To discover more ways faith can enrich your life, visit CatholicCounselors.com.
Fully Alive. Reflections on the scripture readings of today's Mass with Father Pat Egan, chaplain of Ave Maria Radio.
What does it mean to follow Jesus, to be his disciple? The Sunday's Gospel helps us here. Jesus has just revealed to his disciples that he is the Messiah, and now he teaches them what kind of Messiah he is and what his followers must be like. It's not what we'd expect, so listen up. Jesus began a journey through Galilee. He was teaching his disciples and telling them, "The Son of Man is to be handed over to men, and they will kill him. And 3 days after his death, the Son of Man will rise." And they didn't understand the saying, and they were afraid to question him. And they came to Capernaum, and once inside the house, he began to ask them, "What were you arguing about on the way?" And they remained silent, because they'd been discussing who was the greatest. Then he sat down, called the 12 together, and said to them, "If anyone wishes to be first, he should be the last of all and the servant of all." And taking a child, he placed it in their midst, putting his arms around him, and said, "Whoever receives a child such as this in my name receives me. And whoever receives me receives not me, but the one who sent me." He teaches the 12 the designated future leaders of the church, they must lead by following his example of service, service with love and sacrifice. We must be servants of all, especially the weak and helpless. I'm Father Pat Egan, chaplain to Ave Maria Radio, commenting on this Sunday's Gospel. Remember, inspired by the Word of God, you too can be more fully alive.
Today's programming on 990 WDEO is brought to you in part by a contribution made from our day sponsor. To celebrate the birthday of Connie Andrus, a wonderful wife, mother, and grandmother, we couldn't live without you. You are a blessing from God. Happy birthday, Mom. You can be a day sponsor, too. Call toll-free 1-877-288-1077 and say, "I want to be a day sponsor."
This is Lavinia Spirito for Catholic Way Bible Study. In John 6, Jesus teaches about giving himself to us in the Eucharist.